histories of the Revolutionary Union, the industrial workers of the world in the United States, typically end at around 1918. Our episode 6 recounts the early history of the Union. So if you haven't heard that, I'd go back and listen to that first. While the RWW was heavily repressed during World War I, it continued to grow after the war ended and played an important role in organising in areas like construction in Nevada, manufacturing in Cleveland, the auto industry in Detroit, and amongst Finnish communities in Minnesota. This is Working Class History.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then join in the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share like a man. There is power in the band of working men.
When they stand,
hand
in hand,
that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
The heyday of the IWW was from its foundation in 1905 up until 1918, but it remained influential in some sectors up until the 1950s. Today, we're continuing our series of episodes about the IWW, so we've come to Chicago, its historic home, to talk to our friend Warren and learn more about this little-known period in the Union's history.
Warren, thanks very much for speaking with us today. To start off with, could you tell us a bit about what your connection is with the industrial workers of the world?
Well, I've been either a sympathizer, a member, an elected officer, or an employee of the IWW for the past 12 years. And also in my spare time, as a side interest, I've dug a lot into the history of the Union.
Okay, and in particular, a history after World War I, which is not so well known. So starting with that, often historians say that the histories of the IWW end in 1918. And a standard narrative is often that the Palmer raids, so repression against the Union, broke it due to its opposition to World War I. Is that accurate?
I would say no, that it isn't accurate. The Palmer raids actually came 2 years after the initial raids on the IWW in 1917. I believe the Palmer raids were less focused as far as the IWW is concerned. But the raids and the repression didn't destroy the IWW. And according to some sources, the organization actually grew post-World War I. The repression did, however, create a necessity for certain responses, and the way that the organization handled the response to the repression were more impactful than the repression itself, which led to a really bitter internal culture arguing over some of the impacts and some of the details that they faced out of the World War I era repression.
What were the issues at stake there?
Well, one of the issues was a lot of Wobblies were rounded up, and a lot of them were in these mass trials for espionage, various charges, and almost all of them were convicted. This included people that hadn't been members of the IWW in years, that hadn't been connected to the organization. So hundreds of people sat in federal prison. When the prospects for getting released came, it was very contentious on how that would go about. There were certain people that were in favor of direct action to get people out of jail, and the IWW actually called for a number of strikes in, I believe, about 1923 to get prisoners released. There was also an offer made by the government, which it seems pretty obvious it was intended to sort of split and make the whole issue controversial, where you could apply for individual clemency to the president of the United States. And then there was people that just thought that they could do it through normal legal defense and appeals. So there was sort of like three different like ways that people thought they could get these prisoners released. And it was very contentious between the different positions. Another thing that really impacted the Union is that one of its founders, Big Bell Haywood, actually, when he got out on appeal, he took off to the Soviet Union. Him and I think there were a few others, I don't remember correctly how many there were. And I think it was the Soviet Union promised to reimburse the IWW for the bail. Of course, that never happened. And that bail, some of it was tied up in people's homes. So some people lost homes from Bill Haywood leaving. And at least one instance, it sort of led to some events where one of those homeowners that lost their home and a member ended up committing suicide. this was just another thing where, like, it wasn't necessarily the repression itself, but some of the decisions made that really antagonized things. It also antagonized something that has always existed in the IWW, and that's the tension between centralism and decentralism. I guess the best way to describe that is, if you're familiar with most like similar European radical unions, they're more organized on a federal basis. So you have these groups and they mostly take care of their own affairs and then come together at certain regular times to decide what all of them should be doing or what they adhere to. IWW has always been very different. It's always been more centralist. I think typically in the United States, local autonomy in unions is often associated with corruption, which might not be the case in Europe, but in the United States it is. So the IWW was more centralist. There's a central body that charters branches. There's officers that are in charge of certain things and have a certain amount of authority. And that's always been a tension, and the repression further antagonized that tension. And it eventually led to a split in 1924 between what they called the centralists and the decentralists. The split only involved a few hundred people, but the atmosphere that it created, in which people were accused of being agents of the state, secret communists, all this, it created an atmosphere where people no longer wanted to maintain their membership, and scores of people left. So those issues came up because of repression, but it still existed even after the split. It still existed. It still did organizing.
Between centralism and federalism or decentralism, what prevailed in the organization?
So the centralists won. The 1924 split, the decentralists, which actually they split, they called themselves the IWW as well. At a point, there were two IWWs. And in some areas, like the Pacific Northwest, there might be an IWW hall across from a different IWW hall that reflected that split. But they eventually went defunct in around, the decentralist split went defunct in, I believe, 1931. So the centralists won out. But I think by saying centralist, you can give sort of a wrong idea about how the IWW was organized. I think it was sort of complex, and especially during the pre-World War I era, but definitely even into the 30s, the IWW is as much a social movement as it is a formal organization. So it sort of depends on the circumstance, time, and place, how centralist it actually was. In general, it would have been more centralist than other similar radical unions in the world, but other IWW groups in other countries pretty much operated completely autonomous in ways that they don't nowadays. We're a little bit differently structured.
Okay, so in the period following World War I, early 20s, what were the main geographical areas and industries where the IWW was organizing and was active and had membership?
So they were pretty strong in the Northwest United States, Southwest Canada, in like the logging industries. They also were strong in northern Minnesota and Ontario, specifically with Finnish immigrant workers. And on the docks in Philadelphia, in Cleveland, specifically metal manufacturing, and Colorado, where they were strong in mines. But they also had a presence in marine transport. I don't know as much about that because the records aren't as easily found. And these workers are often mobile, going all over the world. But they had a strength on, you know, like merchant ships.
Right. And I think they were people who helped spread the IWW internationally, like down to Chile and places like that.
Yeah, that's how I understand it, is they would go to a place, you know, talk to somebody. Borders, I think, are harder now to get through, where I think at that time, workers could really go all over the place in ways that it is a lot harder to do now. And so ideas spread. Any working class ideas were easy to spread person to person back then.
What were the most sort of significant disputes that the IWW engaged in over this time period?
There were a few pretty major campaigns and disputes that the IWW was involved in. I already mentioned the general strikes that they called for the prisoner releases. They also were involved in a strike at what became the Hoover Dam, and that was in 1931. In 1932, they really pushed for organizing in Detroit in the auto industry, and they were involved in a strike at, I believe it was called Briggs, and they weren't the only party involved. This is a point where there are, you know, at this point, 1932, there are just all types of radical groups or even aspiring unions that are looking at Detroit as this is where we should be. So in the strike, not only do you have the IWW, but you have the Communist Party, you have various other socialist groups, you have, I believe, even a Catholic union, you have some smaller sort of proto-unions. So there's a lot of things going on. They were involved in that strike, and it kind of was a win. They didn't win all their demands, but they did get a 10% raise. The second strike of that year was Murray Body, and again, also in the auto industry in Detroit. And that did not have as favorable of a outcome. The strike was lost, and basically the IWW's presence and efforts and hopes in Detroit were pretty much done right there. But, I mean, it's sort of an interesting what if. You know, what if the IWW had succeeded on that strike and moved on to bigger and better things? Because only a few years later, you see the UAW, the United Automobile Workers, win strikes. And that sort of sets the precedent for what unionism is going to look like in the United States. So it's something, when I came across, was sort of an interesting what if. Like, what would have happened if the IWW would have won this strike and continued growing? Things might look a lot different in the United States today. Some other campaigns that they're involved in are in the mines in Colorado. That was always a strong point for the IWW, is the mines. Two more things is the Harlan County War, which was in Kentucky. There was a series of pretty violent confrontations between workers who were trying to unionize and the companies. And the IWW was heavily involved in the defense for some of those miners. And then also they tried to establish unemployed unions once the Depression hit.
Could you tell what happened in the Hoover Dam dispute?
So the Hoover Dam dispute, the way IWW organizing happened, there's a couple different ways it did happen. Sometimes a group of workers were sort of angry about their situation and, you know, ready to go, and they contacted the IWW. In modern union terminology, that's called a hot shop. And then the IWW would often send in outside organizers to link up with the local workers and help them try to win this strike. Other times it was sort of a concerted effort to like build a presence in a place. In the docks in Philadelphia, it seemed like that was it. The Hoover Dam was dispute was something different, where you had, as I understand it, a traveling IWW organizer that sort of was paid a small amount of money, enough to like live on, and would travel an assigned geographic area to try to get startup groups and, you know, get campaigns going. So that seemed to what happened with the Hoover Dam strike. I mean, the conditions were terrible. They were housed in basically like tin shacks in the desert. And some of their demands were just sort of incredible to think about, but just to have ice in the water that they were provided, because the water that they provided was, you know, hot by the time, by the end of the day. So the IWW became involved in that strike. Unfortunately, this was at a time where a lot of workers and the IWW generally was sort of repulsive to people. So the IWW really struggled to even gain the support of workers who were on strike. And I believe a group of the strikers actually issued a letter denouncing the IWW, at the same time sort of like wink, wink, like accepting their assistance. So they thought they could do it alone, but wanted some assistance, but also was afraid of what being associated with the IWW would bring their efforts. And the strike was eventually defeated. They had an encampment, and eventually it just whittled down to the most hardcore of strikers or IWW members, and it was mostly defeated. There were concessions made, as there are in many union campaigns. you know, employers try to make a concession, but then they don't say it's because of the union. But overall, it would probably be considered a loss because it didn't gain membership for the union, and they couldn't take credit for any gains that weren't made.
Yeah, my understanding in the Colorado mines this was 1926, 1927, something similar happened where the IWW organized a strike, which became very big and successful, and it did achieve a number of concessions, including union recognition, but not for the IWW. So they agreed to recognize another union to keep out the IWW, which, when you say that, you know, obviously employers had a repulsion for the IWW, but what was the issue that workers had with it?
Well, the sort of statement that I read doesn't get into it that much, but looking at the context of sort of the World War I era anti-IWW propaganda that was spread, and then just the sheer amount of repression. In 1931, if you were a worker, and this is the first you come across the IWW, your reference point for what they are is going to be based on employer and government propaganda from the World War I era. So you might not want to be associated with that. I'm sure you would also be aware that there were vigilante groups that were established during the World War I era to, you know, expel the IWW out of towns and in some case assassinate key leaders. So although I don't know for sure, I would assume that if you were a worker in 1931, you would be aware of that and you would be apprehensive towards being associated with the union, especially in an instance where it's just a traveling organizer that came through and that's something that had like a previous long-term presence.
So going back to the dispute in Cleveland that you mentioned, what happened there?
Well, the IWW's presence in Cleveland, and which was a little broader than Cleveland, but was mostly based there, was probably the most significant campaign and effort of the IWW in this period. They had strikes and campaigns at dozens of small to mid-size manufacturing enterprises in Cleveland. They had a real, like, sort of cultural presence, and that went on from, you know, late 20s until the 50s. But it was definitely probably their most significant base. After a certain point, they don't really have a base in many cities, but in Cleveland, they're very active and they are growing during this period.
Was that mostly in the manufacturing sector?
Yeah, mostly in manufacturing, but also in other industries too. They had some organization in department stores, which were mostly women workers. But yeah, mostly it was manufacturing. I believe a little bit in construction too, but the big things were the manufacturing.
So you mentioned cultural activities that the union did. Could you tell us some more about that?
Well, in Cleveland, there was a pretty strong Junior Wobblies group and organization. And Junior Wobblies was sort of like the kids' auxiliary group. And there were also in northern Minnesota and in Ontario, among the Finnish workers, there were a number of sort of like institutional type things and various cooperatives. And they had a institution called Work People's College, which began sometime in the 19-teens and ran all the way until 1941. And it was originally an effort of this Finnish Socialist Federation. And the IWW took it over at a certain point. And it was a school where workers could go to and they could stay there and live there and learn how to do a number of things. They taught classes on economics. They taught lessons on Marx's writings, public speaking, bookkeeping, learning English, math, all types of things that workers wanted to learn. And in general, the Finnish IWW and the cooperatives provided sort of like an institutional basis that I think has not got its proper recognition, really. And part of that is probably because a lot of it isn't in English. And that's the problem with a lot of focus on the IWW, which is can be very sort of American centric, and I'm, you know, I've fallen into that too. But even within the United States, stuff that's not in English, it's harder if you don't speak those languages to find out about it. But yeah, the Finnish IWW published a newspaper in their native language till the 1970s. So they lasted, where other IWW groups that didn't have that sort of institutional support and basis disappeared. You know, they went on until, you know, the 1970s.
And so I guess that's one of the areas where it showed how the IWW had a different view of unionism, that it wasn't just about work, but it was broader than that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was. You know, if you look at something like Junior Wobblies, like providing a space for children to partake in activities, you know, providing a place for workers to educate themselves. And, you know, this is nowadays, it's, I think, probably most workers at least have a partial community college education. But, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, like, college is not a thing that most working people have access to. So sort of providing that, you know, like, popular education thing was a big part of the IWW. And even in its publications, and you see the debates that they have and the literature and the art that are discussed, these were educated people that cared about culture. They cared about not only their organization's efforts, but also, like, what type of culture were workers going to produce in the here and now, and what kind of culture would be produced in the future.
On that note, you know, that you mentioned, does the IWW still have much documentation from these, you know, non-English language publications and things somewhere?
The records of the IWW are sort of scattered and sometimes hard to find. I mean, in 1917, I believe every single IWW union hall in the United States was raided, and their membership lists, publications, all of it were seized by the Justice Department. Also, things that got sent through the mail were stopped by the post office. And then in Canada, the IWW was outright banned. So a lot of those materials from that era are incomplete, or they're scattered in various archives around the United States. And I'm sure a lot of this stuff is actually still in the possession of the federal government in some warehouse somewhere.
On this note, I did find one snippet of IWW history, which was about a domestic workers' union that was started, and a woman who is a key organizer in it wrote a letter to the Industrial Worker, the newspaper of the IWW, about it, and that letter was seized en route, but it came to light sort of decades later, you know, when I think it was found in government records, you know, because they'd seized it. So it was kind of an interesting bit of history that was preserved by it being seized.
There's been a recent book written by, his name is Eric Chester, and he wrote a book called The Wobblies in Their Heyday. And in the book, he describes actually tracking down some of these materials that the Justice Department still had and had been misclassified for years. A lot of the basis of that book, he says, are on these records that he found 100 years later, still in the possession and misclassified in the Justice Department. So yeah, there's, who knows how much material is still out there. It's possible we could still be finding out things that we didn't know about, or that would change our view of the organization in that period.
Well, there's potential research work for any, you know, historians listening. If anyone, you know, any Finnish speakers want to help look through some of the old Finnish stuff, and, you know, do some research about it, drop us a line. It would be interesting to find out more. Obviously, around this same time period, another big, you know, world event had an effect on a lot of movements, which was the Russian Revolution, the Soviet Union, and then the rise of the world communist parties. Presumably that had an impact on the IWW as well.
Yeah, just like pretty much all of the left, and even outside of the left, if you want to consider liberals, but outside of it, liberals were excited too. The IWW was enthusiastic about the Russian Revolution initially, but that soon turned to bitter opposition to not only the Communist Party in the United States, but the Soviet Union. There was a lot of arguments and discussions within the organization about the Communist Party. also about the sort of international structures that the Soviet Union set up to try to facilitate cooperation amongst the far left. The IWW attended some of these, like the Red International for trade unions, and they did not agree with what they were being told to do. They were being told to pretty much dissolve into like sort of a political organization that works within the American Federation of Labor. And the IWW, part of its founding was that the mainstream unions were ill-equipped to organize workers, so that they needed a dual union, as sometimes it is called. But the arguments in the organization about the Communist Party took up a lot of time and energy. There were some key people that left the IWW and for the Communist Party. Overall, somewhere between 15 and 20% of the membership is estimated to have left the IWW for the Communist Party, which was not a huge amount, but I believe it did involve, you know, people that were organizers and people that had experience. And the Communist Party, at least in the United States, had an organized faction within the IWW, at least until 1929, to sort of fight for what they believed the IWW should be doing, which should dissolve into the American Federation of Labor. Ironically, right around 1929, the Communist Party switched to dual unionism and actually created its own dual union, the Trade Union Unity League. So today, when people remark back on these conflicts, and a lot of things are sort of slung towards the IWW as like, well, you're creating a rival union. Socialists did that too. And I think that's a history that's somewhat forgotten.
And also around the same time as this is going on, there's the Great Depression. I guess you mentioned the IWW is like trying to organize among the unemployed. Was that during the Depression or beforehand?
I think that there were sporadic local attempts to figure out what to do with unemployed workers. Because what would happen is you would have a strike, and then the employer would bring in basically people who are unemployed as strike breakers. So it's something that the IWW and unions in general have always, you know, had struggled with, trying to figure something out. With the Depression, the IWW did try to create unemployed unions. There were, I think, the ones with the most members were in Chicago. And this was at a time where there were a lot of such groups. The Communist Party also created their I think they were called the Unemployed Councils. There were also other socialist groups that started unemployed groups too. But they were pretty much about trying to either support striking workers by not scabbing, so organize the potential strike breakers and people that would cross picket lines, but also try to pressure local governments or local employers to provide some sort of relief. Along with the Depression, the Depression brings unemployment, but also brings other changes. Because of the number of strikes and that incoming presidential administration with Franklin Roosevelt, there is a national standard and framework created for union elections and contracts, which is called the National Labor Relations Act. So that sort of creates a way for unions to file for representation election and get into negotiations for employers. Previous to that, it was a patchwork across the United States on how that was determined. And so that really changes things, because it becomes a thing where, okay, if the IWW is not signing contracts in a place, a different union can come in and raid. So they could come in, have a few workers sign cards, have an election, and then the other union becomes the official union of the place. And the employer will say, well, we have to negotiate with them, not the IWW. And that happened a lot in Cleveland, which is why in Cleveland they eventually started signing contracts because of these raids from the CIO and the AFL.
Right, yeah, because historically the IWW didn't sign contracts with employers.
Yeah, I believe that's true. There may have been some some examples of it, but also contracts were a little bit different back then too, previous to the NLRA.
So the IWW did experience some raids by the union branches at this time. Did the signing of contracts have any other, perhaps unforeseen consequences?
Well, I mean, it created a debate within the organization. I don't think it got to the point of some other debates, because at this point, Cleveland is not the only thing going on for the IWW, but definitely one of the few bright spots that it has. I guess the consequences for signing contracts and sort of accepting this legal framework is that they later get into a choice between having to do what the federal government wants them to do as far as if you want to maintain these contracts. So the sort of consequence for this is, as labor law changes and adds new restrictions, the IWW then has to make a choice between, do we accept these new restrictions or do we accept not being able to sign contracts? And with Cleveland, it ended up as there was a labor law called Taft-Hartley, which required an anti-Communist Party pledge from union officers. So it required union officers to say that they were not a member of the Communist Party. The IWW in general, even though they were no fans of the Communist Party, objected towards that because they believed that the government should have no say in who their officers are. It's none of their business. Cleveland, though, believed that this is something that they had to do in order to maintain a presence and maintain these contracts. And so they implored the rest of the organization to vote to accept this so they could maintain the presence. And the vote went the other way. The IWW refused to have its officers sign anti-communist pledges, and the IWW in Cleveland left the IWW. So that's sort of a consequence of, during this period, entering into this framework that the federal government had set up, is eventually, while it led to like stability at that point, eventually led to a choice between violating principles or becoming almost a defunct organization.
And so other things that unions could be tied into, could that also be things like not being able to call strikes and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's also a thing with contracts, at least in the United States, is typically there are, the employer wants to include a no-strike clause in the contract that says the union won't strike for the life of the contract, and instead will place it in a grievance procedure where you file a grievance and then a union rep and a company rep meet. And then if that doesn't work, it gets kicked up to another one and another one. It's all about like sort of maintaining production and taking disputes on the work floor, on the workplace floor, off there and into a room between officials. So that's also a consequence. I don't know if at that point, no strike clauses had been sort of automatically included. Today they are. It's very rare that they're not included, but they probably were back then too.
So, you know, that was another challenge for the IWW at that time. What were some other problems? I mean, I can imagine that, you know, the IWW was a union. It was always a revolutionary union that, you know, had the goal of overthrowing capitalism. And a lot of that, the time period 1940s, not a very revolutionary time period, you know. Around this period, you know, you got Roosevelt and his New Deal, which I guess implemented a lot of Keynesian sort of reforms, you know, implemented a bit of a welfare state in America that historically had one. And, you know, I guess in other areas where that happened, that was quite successful at derailing kind of revolutionary movements. Was it a similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the establishment of, you know, a welfare state was something that most radical unions that exist in the world really struggled to be able to deal with. Initially, I think in the early 30s, if you were a member of the IWW in the early 30s, I don't think it would have been clear to you that your organization was on some sort of inevitable decline. And in fact, you could point at a number of things, some of which we've already mentioned, is like that, oh, we're just as active as ever. Like there are all these prospects for growing. So I don't think at that time you'd be able to see that. But as time goes on, and I think that trying to find a way to deal with some of these new social measures implemented is something that the IWW struggled with. I mean, some of their responses to it, they regarded the New Deal as a form of fascism. And that was actually a somewhat common response for the left. Today, thinking about it, like thinking of Social Security or unemployment insurance as fascism is sort of laughable. But at the time...
Because we'll try and defend it, you know.
Yeah.
We'll try and defend what we have, you know, that's, yeah.
But at the time, that's not necessarily how the left, and specifically the IWW, would have viewed that. They would have seen that as an attempt by the state to try to incorporate the working class into the state. So I think that they really struggle with how to sort of think of a narrative around that or think of a response to that.
Yeah, because I guess when essentially the United States, the state and the employers were essentially at war with workers, you know, workers would be locked up, executed, massacred, you know, shot or whatever, it's kind of easier for people to then think that they want to overthrow that system. Whereas when that system changes, you know, and tries to, you know, essentially give more rights to unions to incorporate them into that state system, overthrowing it then maybe becomes less of a necessity. And
I think that they believed that it would promote sort of like a feeling of reliance on the government, and sort of they would be not inclined to, you know, want to change society or even to try to make gains. Obviously, with the number of strike waves that happened afterwards, I think that's sort of proven false. You know, people had Social Security, they had, in some instances, the benefits they from the military, like the post-World War II strike wave, and they still went on these massive, just giant strikes that are sort of hard to comprehend nowadays. So I don't think that was necessarily true, that it prevented people from acting. It's possible that it did sort of put a damper on a more revolutionary perspective. And that's something that I think a lot of the left has struggled to with parts of the state that then begin to provide benefits. If before you were never provided anything and they're all the same, all politicians are the same, and then someone comes along that's not the same, those previous criticisms are not necessarily true.
I think that stands again today, where I guess particularly amongst anarchists who maybe had a reasonably shallow view that, you know, elections were bad because all politicians were the same. And then you get people like Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders, who, you know, they're not the same as Tony Blair or Hillary Clinton. You know, they sort of abandoned the revolution thing and are like, you know, vote Bernie, vote Jeremy.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that even today there's some difficulty in dealing with that. What happens when the state or portions of the state pivot at least partially towards what could be construed as the interest of the working class? It's happened in the past. It's happened in this period that we're talking about. And to a certain extent, it's happening today. But, like, how do you respond to that? Back then, I think I'm not sure that the IWW came up with a way. And then today, I think most people are still trying to figure that out. How do you, if you're in the UK and you don't think that the UK government can provide what the working class needs and what it should have, how do you make that argument as, when you have someone like Corbyn? You know, it's a little harder. You can make it, but it's a little harder.
Yeah. So you mentioned the decline of the union in Cleveland. What about elsewhere? What happened to it?
Well, I think that in some places, the locals just aged out. The IWW didn't attract newer members or younger members, and union halls eventually became a bunch of, you know, sort of older guys, some of which are maybe not even working anymore until a point where they can't even afford an office. I think that happened in a number of places. I think that's a major reason for its decline. But also, as mentioned before, the repression of World War I period provoked such a disastrous and destructive debate that it just pushed so many people away. And also, you know, as we mentioned, some of its positions about the Communist Party and the Soviet Union, they were unpopular on the left. I think it's hard to really think of it now, but there was a time where if you said something negative about the Soviet Union, you were in the minority and you were not very popular. So in a way, they were sort of Soviet Union skeptics before, you know, it was acceptable to be so. And so a lot of people, even like liberal at that point in the 30s, even the 40s, even liberals looked positively towards the Soviet Union and the Communist Party. And many of them were in you know, their front groups or members. So I think that was a very unpopular position on the left. And I think that also it hurt the IWW.
But I guess at the same time, I guess history has shown that was, you know, the correct view.
Yeah, I mean, that's the position that they should have took. I mean, they looked at what they wanted them to do and what the USSR stood for and how things played out. And they didn't see, it didn't match up with what most IWW members wanted a future, what a future world would look like. And they saw that very early.
On a related note, do you know how Bill Haywood got on in the Soviet Union?
So Bill Haywood, there's a number of different accounts about this, but as far as I know, he lived in Moscow. He married a woman that he met in Moscow, and he was involved in some of the first meetings of what was called the Third International, which was a worldwide group of all the like pro-Soviet socialist parties. I think he sort of became disillusioned with his life in Moscow and eventually drank himself to death. That's the account that I heard. I mean, you'd have to think he would have been pretty isolated, an American in Soviet Union in the early 1920s. He was definitely isolated from the IWW after fleeing, so I don't think he had that connection. It just seems the sort of sad to me. But I believe his body was put in the Kremlin Wall in Red Square, I believe.
Right. I guess that's something you could potentially go visit one day. Okay, and so the stuff that we're talking about, it happened a while ago, and it's not, you know, this time period is not what's considered the heyday of the IWW that gets talked about more. So why is it you think that this period, you know, that these events are important to have an understanding of for us today as, you know, workers?
I think this period of the IWW, the, you know, 1920s to the, I guess, early 1950s is pretty relevant. And I would even argue that it's more relevant than the heyday of the organization. A lot of things are different then, but they're the issues such as like the response to labor law is something that workers and unions are dealing with today. We have those same laws. Those laws are all still on the books. And as the economy and as what employers will tolerate and what the government is willing to do have changed, the unions and workers also have to change. So you have to think, how do we respond to labor law in 2018? The argument has been made by some that in order to increase membership and actually grow the labor movement, the law is going to have to be broken, that the law is no longer relevant. It's constricting. So I think looking at how the IWW responded to those changes, and if you're able to track down some of like the internal documents of that debate, I think have a lot to show us on how do we respond to these things and see the arguments. A lot of the arguments are some sort of the same. That's sort of like pragmatism versus, you know, we're a revolutionary group. I also think that the issue of decentralization versus centralization is something that is sort of universal for any type of social movement or radical group. And you've seen it in Occupy. You've seen it in Black Lives Matter. It's something that continuously comes up. So I think looking at past debates on how people spoke about it, what their thoughts are on it, I think are relevant because it's something that's never been resolved. Also, I think the IWW's vision of trying to balance between economic gains and long-term political goals of radical social change is something that anybody on the far left should be interested in. because those are also questions that have not been fully resolved. How do we do this? And then the last thing about this period that I think is pretty important is I think that realizing that organizational conflict is before an audience that can walk out at any time is something that more people on the left should be aware of. There's always going to be conflict and disagreement. That's not bad. That's how people figure out solutions and, you know, figure out what these balances between interests. But you need to realize that the people that are not involved in the argument are watching it. And often it doesn't matter whether someone's wrong or right. A lot of people just look, oh, that person's being mean. They're both being mean to each other. And this is all I see. I don't want any parts of this. And the IWW during that period is a good example of what happens when you don't conduct yourself within an organization with that in mind. People leave.
There is power in the band of working men when they stand
hand in hand.
That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
To learn more, we've got links to further reading in the show notes below, and we've also got a link there to a playlist of IWW music on YouTube. We have more episodes on other aspects of the IWW coming up, so listen out for those. Thanks to Warren for speaking with us. Thanks to Jesse French for editing this episode. Thanks to you for listening, and special thanks to our Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. If you'd like to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Where you also get benefits like exclusive early access to episodes, access to bonus audio, free merch, and more. We've also got a YouTube channel where we post short video histories of different events. So check that out and subscribe at youtube.com/workingclasshistory. Catch you next time.
Come all ye workers from every land, come join in the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share like a man. There is power in the band of working men. When they stand
hand in hand.
That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand.